from these windows to the past. This window will show you a glimpse of the momentous life of Baha'u'llah. Regardless how hard one tries, it will be impossible for any speaker to portray and capture the true spirit of the majestic and yet tragic events of the life of Baha'u'llah. This presentation will approach the history of the life of Baha'u'llah from different angles in hope of giving you a glimpse of what actually transpired. We have less than 1 minute to talk about every year of his life, which lasted 75 years, 40 years of which were his ministry. Let us go back in time about 150 years and review a few events in Tehran and Baghdad in 19th century. Tehran, as is now, was the capital of Iran, known to Westerners as Persia. Baghdad is the provincial capital of Iraq, and Iraq is like a state or province in the great Ottoman or Turkish Empire. The year is 1839 and we are in Tehran. The king is the inept Muhammad Shah, who depends so much on his crafty and notorious prime minister, Haji Mirza Aghasi. A prominent member of the court, Mirza Bozorg from Nur, has died and must be replaced. As is customary, his position is offered to his most qualified son. One of his sons, Mirza Hussein Ali, though only 22 years old, seems to excel not only in knowledge and wisdom, but also in character. Matter of fact, the prime minister has watched him firsthand when he represented his father in a court case. The prime minister's deputies pay a visit to Mirza Hussein Ali and offer him the position. Disappointed, they return to the prime minister with a negative response. The prime minister is not quite pleased and somewhat puzzled as to why anyone in sane mind would not accept such a position which is so profitable. He was here to tell his deputies, "I cannot understand him. Leave him to himself. He has greater aims in mind." Only if he had known who this young nobleman really was. About 10 years later, in a poor town by the Caspian Sea called Bandar-e-Gaz, in a beautiful early fall afternoon, seagulls having fun and a big reception on its way in the honor of a well-known nobleman visiting the town. There is a rumor that he had joined a new movement called the Babi faith, but so what? There are so many sects of Islam, and this seems to be another one. He still believes in Muhammad, and so it does not matter. It is his magnetic personality and charisma which shines like a jewel and attracts everyone. All dignitaries are invited. Among them is a Russian officer. Russia, being a strong neighboring country, has tremendous authority and influence over the government of Iran. Before the reception begins, a messenger on horseback arrives from Tehran, handing the urgent and shocking message to the mayor. After reading it with a pale face, the mayor looks at the messenger, who states, "It is true. I'm told that the king has stated, 'I can no longer stand the activities of Mirza Hussein Ali. He must be arrested wherever he may be and brought to the capital for execution.'" What is the mayor to do? Consulting with his deputies, they decide that the nobleman will not run away. Might as well, not to spoil the reception, and handcuff him after the reception is over. They see to it that after he entered the mansion, the guard would prevent him from leaving. The reception starts on time, and as usual, everyone praising each other, but carefully worded praise for the nobleman. After all, they are all the king's men. The Russian officer, hearing the word from one of the deputies, approaches the nobleman, telling him the message for his arrest, and offers his ship, which is anchored at the port, as asylum. But the nobleman, to the utmost surprise of the Russian man, tell him, no need to worry, everything will be all right. And so, he declines his offer. It does not make sense to the officer why anyone should refuse such a generous offer and willingly walk into a death trap. Well, before the reception is over, another messenger arrives with the news that Muhammad Shah has died, the prime minister gone into hiding, and the capital is in turmoil. The reception ends happily, and the order is not carried out. You see, it was not the king who was tired of the nobleman Mirza Hussein Ali, but it was God who was displeased with Muhammad Shah and could not stand him any longer. He and his prime minister, Haji Mirza Aghasi, had to go. They already had caused the Bab, the fruit of the tree of divine revelation, to be imprisoned and then brought to Tabriz for examination, which was followed by bastinado. In process of bastinado, we recall his blessed face was struck. And now they are planning to destroy the future bearer of the light of God. About 3 years later, the heavy-handed new prime minister, Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir, who brought the young king Nasruddin Shah to the throne and already had executed the Bab, now wishes to control Mirza Hussein Ali's activities. He has witnessed how a group of 300 Babis valiantly defended themselves for 7 months against a well-equipped royal army of 10 to 20,000 men, much better equipped with arms. He tells a nobleman, who is now about 33 or 34 years old, that it was your leadership and intelligence that helped so few a number of Babis in Sheikh Tabarsi keep the strong royal army frustrated for nearly 7 months. It would be so helpful to the country and please His Majesty if you use your talent in the service of His Majesty and accept the post of Amir Divan, or the head of the court system, which is a prestigious position with side benefits, which of course we know is extortion and bribes. The nobleman denies having anything to do with the defense at Fort Sheikh Tabarsi, and gives the credit to the selfless dedication of the believers and declines the offer. Well, this prime minister had the blood of the Bab on his hand, and within a year, he was deposed by the king whom he had brought to the throne. His vein was opened in the bath, and his life slowly oozed away. Now it is 4 to 5 years later, and we are in Baghdad, which I told you is the provincial capital of Iraq, one of the provinces of the powerful Turkish Empire. As background information, the Bab was executed in 1850, and 2 years later, three deranged and revengeful Babis tried to kill the young king, which failed. The nobleman, with about 30 other prominent Babi leaders, was put into underground dungeon called the Siyah Chal, or the Black Pit. Nearly all other prominent leaders were put to death with unspeakable brutality, but somehow the nobleman Mirza Hussein Ali was found to be innocent from plotting the attempt on the life of the Shah and was freed, pending his immediate exile to Baghdad. His luxurious mansion had been ransacked and all of his properties confiscated by the government. To purchase very inadequate provisions for the travel of the family in the dead of winter over icy and snowbound mountain passes of western Iran, his wife had plucked the jewel buttons off some of her dresses before the mob attacked their mansion. She sold these to buy the scant equipment for their travel. The nobleman was recovering from typhoid fever, a deadly disease, and leech wounds on his ankles from the ankle-deep muck of the dungeon. Under severe hardship, they arrived in Baghdad, and the next act of this great drama is a few years after their arrival. If you wish to watch it closely, all men must wear turban, and women, the famous chador, or the veil, peeking with only one eye. The nobleman is settled in a house, although not a mansion, but it has become the focal point of people from all walks of life, from Persian princes in exile to Christian, Jewish, and Muslim clergy or laymen. Material comfort is not there anymore. Matter of fact, his household barely makes the ends meet. By the way, if tea is served, make sure you don't take too much sugar. It is expensive. We are in his reception room filled with people, some regulars and some for the first time. You are among the first timers, but I have been there before. The outpourings of the nobleman's wondrous word illuminating any subject has left everyone spellbound. Of a few large turban clergy, there is one who appears quite restless and has something in his mind. Who is he? His name is Mullah Hassan Amu and is sent there by the doctors of Islam and clergy of the two holy cities of Karbala and Najaf, the home of the largest theologian schools of Islam about 50 miles from Baghdad. Are you with me or lost in wonderment? Mullah Hassan, seated on the floor like the rest, but gradually inches his way closer to the nobleman and requests a private audience. We are not permitted to be there anymore, but can hear the conversation through the door. Mullah Hassan, already being highly impressed by the nobleman's eloquence and authority, humbly speaks in very low voice. He states, "I represent the chief clergies from the two holy cities." We can't hear him, so we put our ears to the door. By the way, if your turban is in your way, push it to the side. Nobody can see it. "They have sent me to state..." Well, we know all of that. Come on. "They acknowledge your superior knowledge and unmatched wisdom, even though you have not had any formal schooling. But they cannot easily acknowledge your cause and accept it. And only if perchance you could perform a miracle or two to satisfy them." Oh, we wish we could see the look on the nobleman's face. Mullah Hassan's face we can see through the keyhole. He is pale, quivering, and looking at the nobleman's feet. After a pause, the nobleman begins to speak with such authority that it vibrates the building. He states, "It is not your right to ask such a thing. It is for God to test his people, and not for the people to test God." Now his voice becomes merciful. "But since you asked it, we are willing to perform a miracle pending on two conditions. One is that all clergy get together and agree on one miracle. Listen to this. Regardless of what it may be. You see, this is an open offer. The second condition is that a letter should be written, signed, and sealed that should I perform the miracle they choose without hesitation. They must accept and acknowledge the cause for which I stand, and if not performed, I become condemned as an impostor. The cause of God cannot become a plaything of children, every day someone asking for a certain performance. Mullah asks permission to be dismissed. He kisses the nobleman's knees and says, I am satisfied. Now you folks make a guess about the clergy's response. Not only could they not agree about one miracle, but they became afraid of his power and backed off. Mirza Hussein Ali, the nobleman from Nur, was known by his followers as Janab-e Baha, meaning His Honor Baha. Baha is the name he adopted for himself in the conference of Badasht 10 years earlier when he conferred the title of Tahere on Qurratul Ain and Quddus to Muhammad Ali Barfurushi, the last letter of the living. Janab-e Baha was quite reluctant to show the power and glory which was concealed within him to those who wished to test him, but at times he showed a measure of it to those who believed in him to confirm and transform them. While in Baghdad one day, as he was walking with a few followers a few steps behind him, an officer approached him and said, one of your followers has been murdered and his body has been thrown by the river. Janab-e Baha stated, he was not murdered. Through 70,000 veils of light, to an extent smaller than a needle's eye, we showed him the glory of God, and he no longer could bear the burden of his life. He ended his own life. He was not murdered. This person was Sayyid Ismaili Zawari, whom Baha'u'llah honored with the title of Zabih, or sacrifice. Who was Mirza Hussein Ali, the nobleman from Nur, also known as Janab-e Baha? He was not an ordinary man, a mystic, nor a magician. He was the embodiment of the glory of God. His name was Baha'u'llah, meaning the glory of God, the supreme manifestation, the inaugurator of the Day of God, and the promised one of all religions. He was born on November 12, 1817 in Tehran to a noble and prominent family from the town of Nur. As a baby, he never cried. The stories of his childhood and youth testify to his having supreme and innate knowledge and wisdom. At 18, he married Asiya Khanum, the daughter of another wealthy statesman. When 22 years old, his father, Mirza Buzurge Nuri, passed away, and his position as minister in the royal court was offered to him, which he declined. His family and himself belonged to the Shia sect of Islam, but at the age of 27, he accepted the claim of the Bab, who claimed to be the return of the 12th Imam called Ghaem, and also being the gate, or the Bab, to yet a greater manifestation to come. Baha'u'llah's ancestry goes to the last king, Yazdgird, from Sasanian dynasty, and thus to Zoroaster, the prophet of ancient Iran. In the course of promoting the faith of the Bab, he was imprisoned 3 times and bastinadoed once. The 3rd imprisonment was in the Black Pit or the Siyah Chal of Tehran, along with 30 other Babis, whose prison mates were 150 of the worst criminals. This was on August 15 of 1852, when he was arrested on accusation of conspiracy to kill the king. Barehead and barefoot, he was walked for a few hours under chains to that prison while the onlookers stoned him and spat at him. While under the heaviest chain of Karakohar, weighing 110 pounds around his neck with his feet in stocks, he received intimation about his mission in form of dreams and visions. Once in a dream he heard these exalted words on every side. Verily, we render thee victorious by thyself and by thy pen. Grieve thou not for what had befallen thee, for thou art in safety. And another time, in a vision, he saw a maiden of heaven suspended in the air, pointing to his head and addressing the peoples of the world. By God, he is the beloved of the world, and ye apprehended not. This intimation, according to the Guardian, took place in October 1852. 4 months after his arrest, when nearly all leaders of the faith were put to death, he proved to be innocent of any wrongdoing, so he was freed pending exile to Baghdad. In the heart of winter, when his wife was expecting the fourth child, they crossed the snowbound mountain passes on foot or riding on mules. The young son Mirza Mehdi, about 4 or 5 years old, had to be left behind because he could not stand the rigor of the trip. The oldest son Abdul Baha, about 9 years old, was carried on his uncle's shoulders, and his blessed feet froze. Abdul Baha's feet used to hurt him the rest of his life. The timid and jealous half-brother of Baha'ullah, Mirza Yahya, 13 years younger, who had been in hiding, joined them after their arrival in Baghdad. He caused enough disunity among the believers that it forced Baha'ullah to withdraw and go into seclusion in the mountains of Sulaymaniyyah, 200 miles northeast of Baghdad. And in 2 years, when the family discovered his whereabouts and begged him to return, he consented. During seclusion, he lived in the caves in the mountain. As he stated himself, his companions were the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky. Many nights he went to sleep in the cave without any supper. His luxury food was rice cooked in milk when the shepherds had their sheep in that area. His poetries of those days, Qasidaye Varghawiye, are all about his sufferings. That was the poetry which moved the rowdy and rebellious young man who later became known as Badi, the pride of martyrs or Fakhru Shuhada. Badi, the 17-year-old young man, was the one who delivered Baha'ullah's message to the king of Iran before he was martyred. After his return, his home became the center of attraction in Baghdad, and people from all walks of life flocked to his door. Even the Kurds from the mountain area, who used to listen to him in the coffee house of town when he used to come down for bath, were frequenting his house. Exaggerated reports used to arrive in Tehran about his popularity and prestige. Once the Persian consul wrote that Baha'ullah has amassed such a number of followers that on his signal easily 100,000 people could take up arms and attack Iran. Because of the plotting of the clergy and the Persian consul, the Persian government asked the Turkish Sultan to move Baha'ullah farther away from the border. At the beginning, a deaf ear was given to those complaints from Tehran, since the governors of Baghdad had sent nothing but praiseworthy reports about Baha'ullah to the central government in Istanbul. Finally, with hesitation, the governor of Baghdad, Namiq Pasha, through his deputy, gave the order of the central government to Baha'ullah. This governor had great love and respect for Baha'ullah. Before Baha'ullah left Baghdad for Istanbul, on April 21, 1863, in the Garden of Rizwan, he declared himself to be the promised one of all ages, and also the promised one by the Bab. The trip took 4 months and was not free of incidents. One of them was a scary event when on a steep cliff, Baha'ullah's mule lost its footing and the believers with their hearts in their throats saw him and the mule almost tumbling down the cliffside. But remember, in the Siyah Chawl of Tehran, he was told, "Thou art in safety." Miraculously, the mule regained its footing and disaster averted. The believers had to stop and celebrate his safety as a great festivity. Do you know what happened? A very large jug of rose water broke and perfumed the air, adding to their celebration. No one could erase the memory of that event from their mind. After all, they saw the hand of Providence at work. After his arrival in the capital of Istanbul, many dignitaries paid him a visit, which he did not return as was customary in those days. The only places he visited were mosques and public baths. Just 4 months later, an order came for his further exile. Up to this time, the treatment by the Turkish government was not considered hostile. Even the order to move from Baghdad to Istanbul was in form of invitation rather than order. But when this order came, Baha'ullah's response changed and he called this order unjust because he was innocent of any wrongdoing and that he was exiled without being heard. You see, three opportunities for mankind were badly missed. One was when the Bab came within 30 miles of Tehran to meet the king, but the notorious Prime Minister Haji Mirza Aghasi, the Antichrist of the Babi faith, being afraid for his own position, interfered and sent the Bab to the fortress of Maku. The second opportunity was when Baha'u'llah was in Baghdad, only 50 miles from the center of Islamic learning. These doctors of Islam, instead of interviewing him, sent their agent to ask for a miracle. The third was when Baha'u'llah was in Istanbul. The least the Sultan, who also was the religious head, could have done was to ask for a discussion or debate with the clergy to see what his cause was all about. But the people of power had to be the pawns in the divine plan for fulfillment of prophecies, and yet the history does not show a single incident that anyone who tried to kill or injure Baha'u'llah escaped the punishment of God in this life. Again, history repeats itself. In the middle of a blizzard, inadequately prepared, he, the family, and followers moved to Adrianople, the most eastern corner of Europe. This is the first time in the history of religion that a manifestation of God has stepped on European soil and lived there for a while. His 5 years in Adrianople were stormy. His desperate half-brother, who thirsted for leadership, poisoned him. But he recovered and was left with shaking hands. Since he had been a master of penmanship, he did not take the pen anymore, except for what he wrote to his son Abdu'l-Bahá and his will. While he was proclaiming his cause worldwide by addressing the rulers and the ecclesiastics, the troublemakers did not rest until one hot summer morning, the soldiers surrounded his house and no one knew what was coming. Were all being sent back to Persia or drowned in the sea or what? When they were moved under guards to the seaport in preparation for final exile to Akka, Baha'u'llah revealed his well-known Surah-e Ra'is, Ra'is means the chief, addressed to Ali Pasha, the Prime Minister of the Turkish Empire. In it, Baha'u'llah severely rebuked Ali Pasha and forecast their downfall with Adrianople passing out of their hands and blood flowing everywhere, which were all fulfilled within 8 years. Another hot August day, similar to the day he was taken to the Siyah Chal in Tehran. After having been shipped to Haifa, he, his family and followers, a total of 67 people, were put on a sailboat towards Akka, and his half-brother to Cyprus. To make it more miserable, the government ordered a few of the followers of each to go with the other. When one of Baha'u'llah's followers heard that he should go to Cyprus with Mirza Yahya, he shouted, "Ya Baha'u'l-Abha," and jumped in the sea to drown himself, but was rescued and resuscitated enough to be sent to Cyprus. However, after a few years, he escaped and joined the believers near Baha'u'llah. That August day was so windless that it took all day for that sailboat to cross the bay. Without any shade and inadequate water, the suffering, particularly that of children, needs no description. Baha'u'llah was in a solitary cell behind the bars and the rest of the believers in crowded rooms. Abdu'l-Bahá, now 25 years old, and seeing the crowded situation, chose to sleep in the morgue room on a slab of cold stone. What atrocities! Soon sickness of every kind struck, and some died. It was during that time when a believer badly ill took his last breath, and the message of death was taken to Baha'u'llah. He brought him back to life by advising his secretary to go and chant the healing prayer by his deathbed. It was a couple months short of 2 years since his imprisonment in the cell when a great tragedy happened. It was the death of Baha'u'llah's 22-year-old son, Mirza Mehdi. While deep in prayer, pacing on the rooftop, he fell through the skylight. Baha'u'llah asked him what his wish was. He could have granted any wish. However, Mirza Mehdi begged that if he could be accepted as a sacrifice, so the gates would open and the believers could attain the presence of their Lord. His wish was granted. In a few months, the government needing the barracks for military purposes put the believers in various houses within the city under house arrest. Baha'u'llah was confined to the house of Udi Khammar, also known as the house of Abud, where he revealed the Kitab-e-Aqdas in 1873, 20 years after his intimation in the Siyah-Chal in Tehran and in the midpoint of his ministry. Soon the downfall and assassination of Sultan Abdul Aziz occurred, and course of events eased and the restrictions were removed. After spending 9 years in the disease-ridden and desolate city of Akka, called by him the most great prison, he moved outside the city wall of Akka. The mansion of Bahji built by the wealthy Udi Khammar outside the city of Akka by an oasis was deserted because of the outbreak of disease and was rented for a nominal fee and later purchased. Baha'u'llah's last 13 years of ministry were spent in the comfort of that mansion, and its doors were open to all believers to attain his presence. He ascended at the age of 75 on May 29, 1892, about a century ago, and was laid to rest the same day in a building adjacent to the mansion. Friends, this is the first time in the history of religion that detailed recorded history of birth of a religion and minute accounts of the lives of its authors is left for posterity. What a bounty for us to have access to this knowledge. Let us elaborate on three questions about Baha'u'llah's response to the hostile environment, kind gestures of well-wishers, and the impression of a curious Westerner. First question. Was his life in danger? Yes, every minute of it. The incident of Muhammad Shah's order for his arrest and execution was mentioned earlier. His imprisonment in the Siyah-Chal was for the intention of killing him. His arch enemy was the venomous mother of the young Shah whose murder had been attempted. While in the Siyah-Chal, his food was poisoned by her order, but was so obvious that he did not touch it. During exile in Baghdad, twice he escaped the assassination attempt by a hired gunman. The Persian consul had hired this professional and fearless assassin, offering high rewards. By the gunman's own account, every time that he faced Baha'u'llah, he was filled with awe and remorse and could not use the gun. Once was in the public bath where Baha'u'llah was alone, and the second time was on the street at the vantage point. When in Baghdad, large number of fanatic Muslims, riled up by the consul and the clergy, wished to attack his house and kill him after dark. That afternoon, he walked with his servant to the coffee shop where the ruffian leaders used to frequent. As he approached the coffee house, with vehemence he told his servant, "Our life has been threatened. We have no fear. We are ready for them. Here is our head. all who heard his voice were struck dumb. He stayed in the coffee shop until dark and walked home. No one dared to touch him. When in Adrianople, he was poisoned by his half-brother. He became seriously ill with pain and high fever. His condition was so bad that Dr. Shishmon, who visited him, called it hopeless and terminal. In a few days, the doctor became ill. And when Baha'u'llah's secretary visited him, he stated that he wished to offer his life as ransom for the recovery of Baha'u'llah. This offer was accepted by Baha'u'llah. So the doctor died and Baha'u'llah recovered, but was left with shaking hands. Dr. Shishmon really did not die. He became immortal in the history of the faith. Baha'u'llah was a target of the wrath of three monarchs, two kings of Persia and the powerful Sultan of Turkey. Their intent was to destroy him and crush his cause. All they did was to fulfill the prophecies. The disease-ridden and foul-aired Akka did not kill him. The greatest volumes of his writings were revealed during 24 years of his life in Akka. The second question. Did he take asylum? The incidents of reception in Bandar Aga's and the Russian officer offering his ship as asylum was mentioned earlier. When the attempt on the life of the Shah was made in 1852, he had just returned from a year of visit to the holy cities of Karbala and Najaf, and was hosted by the brother of the Prime Minister, who was also from Nur. The Prime Minister, through marriage, had a distant relationship with Baha'u'llah. As soon as the Prime Minister informed them of what happened and the pending danger, the friends offered horse, money, and provisions for Baha'u'llah to take asylum in a holy shrine, which he refused and rode his horse toward the troubled spot. After 4 months, just released from the Siyah Chawl, ill with deadly typhoid and leech wounds on his feet and ankles, the order of exile issued, Prince Dolgoruki of Russia, who knew the family, offered him asylum in Russia, but was not accepted. He followed what the hand of Providence had destined for him. Then in Baghdad, being the target for fanatical Muslims, with their ignorant clergy and worse, the Persian consul, whose main assignment was to kill him, the Consul General of England visited Baha'u'llah and offered British citizenship, which was normally unattainable, and also safe transfer to India, then a British colony. But Baha'u'llah had the calling from the most great prison in Akka to suffer so mankind could be liberated. In one tablet called Shekar Shekan Shavand, he wrote in Baghdad, "We shall not run away. We pray for calamity. Until the time ordained has come, no one has power over us," which astonished his enemies and assured his friends. The third question. What was his contact with the Westerners? It was Consul General of England, Colonel Sir Arnold Kemble, who paid a few visits to the home of Baha'u'llah in Baghdad. The British were so proud that they rarely visited the home of dignitaries. Therefore, visiting a banished person was very unusual. He paid his respects to Baha'u'llah, but to his disappointment, Baha'u'llah did not accept his offer of British citizenship and safe passage to India. Sir Kemble did not leave anything in writing for posterity, neither did Dr. Shishman. But fortunately, Professor Edward G. Brown, the famous British Orientalist, did so, with his capable pen capturing the effect of that momentous event. I will read only a very small portion of his impression when he interviewed Baha'u'llah in the mansion of Bahji 2 years before his ascension. Quote, "The face of him on whom I gazed I can never forget, though I cannot describe it. Those piercing eyes seemed to read one's very soul. Power and authority sat on that ample brow. No need to ask in whose presence I stood as I bowed myself before the one who is the object of a devotion and love which kings might envy and emperors sigh for in vain." End of quote. Friends, this talk will be incomplete without a glance at Baha'u'llah's writings. There are 15,000 documents at the World Center, either written in his own handwriting or by his secretary bearing his seal. Some of these are in the size of a book, such as Kitab-e-Aqdas or Kitab-e-Iran, and some in form of a short letter or tablets. What other religion can claim such a bounty? In Baghdad, he revealed his mystical writings, such as the Four Valleys and Seven Valleys, spiritual and moral exhortations, such as the Hidden Words, the interpretation of the prophecies of the holy books, and proof of the station of the Bab titled Kitab-e-Iran, or the Book of Certitude. In Adrianople, and later in Akka, he addressed the kings, emperors, and the ecclesiastics, thus proclaiming his faith worldwide. In Akka in 1873, when half of his ministry was over, he revealed his most holy book, or the Kitab-e-Aqdas, which addresses the following four subjects. 1. The laws and ordinances. 2. The institution of successorship. 3. The universal house of justice. 4. Prophecies including the new world order and the next manifestation. Following Kitab-e-Aqdas, his major tablets, such as Ishraqat, Splendors, Bisharat, Glad Tidings, Tajalliyat, Effulgences, Tarazat, Ornaments, Kalamat-e Ferdowsiye, Words of Paradise, Lohe Maqsood, Tablet of Maqsood, Lohe Aqdas, the Most Holy Tablet, and Lohe Dunya, or the Tablet of the World, were written. This group of tablets are considered supplementary to the Kitab-e-Aqdas. The Epistle to the Son of the Wolf, an anthology of his writings, and glance at his life was written in 1891, 1 year before his ascension, the same year that the last tablet, or the Tablet of the World, was revealed. The book of his covenant appointing Abdu'l-Bahá as the center of the covenant was opened and read 9 days after his ascension. This was a brief account of the life of Mirza Hussein Ali Nuri, known as Baha'u'llah, the supreme manifestation of God. May I be forgiven for any shortcoming in this presentation. Thank you. the uniqueness of the Baha'i faith. The Baha'i dispensation is distinguished from all other dispensations with its unique and matchless features, the greatest of which is the unrivaled station of the revelation of Baha'u'llah. All manifestations of the past appeared during various stages of the evolution of man's collective life, namely, from the childhood period of tribal life to the stage of youth or statehood. The last manifestation in the Adamic cycle, the seal of the Prophet Muhammad, stressed the significance of nationhood. The Baha'i revelation, as testified by the Guardian, should be viewed as marking the last and the highest stage in the evolution of man's collective life on this planet, or in other words, the stage of maturity which comes only once to mankind. The golden age of the Baha'i era should be regarded, as far as this planetary life is concerned, as the furthermost limits in the organization of human society. The second glorious feature is the twin manifestations. These two sons of reality being in essence as one, by release of spiritual energies, revolutionized and revitalized the life of mankind to bring about, in fullness of time, the most great peace, when the kingdom of God shall reign. One manifestation, the Bab, or the primal point, through the potency of whom all things originated, and the cycle of fulfillment was inaugurated. The other, Baha'u'llah, the supreme redeemer of mankind, who is the desire of the world and the King of kings, and whose reign will overshadow all manifestations in the next cycle of 5,000 centuries. The third indisputable feature is the fulfillment of the prophecy, the day that shall not be followed by night. The Bab states that the day is the life of a prophet on this earth, and the night is the period from his death to the time of the next manifestation, when only luminaries will shine. In this day of God, the light of Baha'u'llah continues to shine through his covenant in its sublime resplendency and is the source of unity of mankind. This covenant, with its twin interpreters Abdul Baha and Shoghi Effendi, succeeded by the Universal House of Justice, is unparalleled in the history. Abdul Baha, the center of the covenant, the most great branch, has a station above that of an ordinary man in position of successorship. He possessed such powers that truly personified the title given to him by his father, the Mystery of God. Shoghi Effendi, the only guardian of the faith, the last authorized interpreter, the sign of God on earth, was the most precious gift and indeed a priceless pearl. Shoghi Effendi states in the World Order of Baha'u'llah that the gulf that separated the station of Abdul Baha from the station of Baha'u'llah also exists between himself and that of Abdul Baha, but much wider. The fourth feature is the existence of original texts of the sacred writing, the like of which no religion can claim. In the most recent dispensations of Islam and Christianity, we find that only parts of the Quran were written during the lifetime of Muhammad, and the rest within a few years after his passing. The Gospels were probably written some 40 to 60 years after the ascension of Jesus. This sharp contrast is manifested by the existence of more than 15,000 documents written or dictated by Baha'u'llah during 40 years of his ministry and preserved in the archives of the Baha'i Faith at the World Center. The fifth unique feature is the divinely ordained administrative system, which is unlike man-made systems in Islam and Christianity, which were subject to abuse of power and corruption. This new administrative order was originated by Baha'u'llah more than a century ago and presently is in its embryonic form. It will safeguard mankind from all evils inherent to the past systems, and being the fruit of the covenant of Baha'u'llah guarantees the unity of mankind and its survival. Examination of the lives and the times of the manifestations of the past brings to light the sixth unique feature of this faith. Even in the history of the most recent religions, such as Islam and Christianity, the birth date of Muhammad and Jesus are not known. In the Baha'i Faith, we have detailed recorded history of the life of the Bab and Baha'u'llah, which will be a relief for the future religious historians.